Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, Heritage Radio Network podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Aaron Iskoff. We'll talk to Aaron about his new book, The World of Natural Wine, and more. We'll taste something. I don't know what we're going to taste. Jorge may walk something over to talk about, which kind of reflects the book and the natural wine movement and the vibe. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Born in Pennsylvania, but now a British American living in France, Aaron Iskoff made his way out to L.A. at the young age of 23, and even to his surprise, became a prominent Italian wine buyer for famed pizza chef Nancy Silverton. Looking for an escape a few years later, Aaron headed to Paris, working in fashion and organically, no pun intended, made his way into the thriving natural wine scene. He hung with all the Paris natural wine luminaries before moving to Beaujolais, where he got a sense of the real natural wine culture, and started his wine writing and wine making. In 2015, he launched his wine blog, appropriately named Not Drinking Poison, and he also sommeliered at some of Paris's best wine restaurants. Aaron's perseverance and passion for natural wine has led him to write The World of Natural Wine, what it is, who makes it, and why it matters. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Aaron. I'm usually pretty accurate on my intros. Did I hit something wrong?
Yeah, I started the Not Drinking Poison in 2010.
2010?
Yeah, rather than 2015.
What did I say?
2015.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All right. So and I knew that because it's been over a decade. And we're going to talk about that, too.
It became more interesting from 2015, probably.
Yeah. And, you know, it's more legit when it's older. All right. So we're talking to Aaron at Frenchette restaurant in Tribeca. We are in the restaurant during the end of lunch service. So you hear some fun ambient noise. And we're sitting here with Aaron right before one of his book signings. He's in the U.S. and he's on a pretty intensive, tour or a bunch of stops to promote the book. And we'll talk about that. So, Aaron, I want to start this way. And I said this to you offline. A lot of people know who you are because they follow you on the blog, anxious for the book, know you in the business. But there's a lot of people who don't. So if you would indulge me and take a few minutes and talk to me about your journey in life and wine that got you to why we're sitting here today, which is writing, you know, this great book. And I think I led on to some stuff in the intro, so.
Yeah, I think you just about covered it.
That's it? We can go home?
Exactly.
See you later.
I grew up with no wine culture whatsoever.
Where in Pennsylvania?
Around the Westchester area.
So not far from Philly.
No,
not in Philly, but not.
Yeah, not in Philly. Yeah, and then I went to school in Boston at college, and so
Emerson.
Yeah,
Emerson. My wife's alma mater.
Yeah, to make money, I began waiting tables, and the best way to get better tips is to know how to sell wine a little bit. So that's kind of how I got into wine, was waiting tables.
So, just hospitality at the basic level interested you. You were like, let me embed myself a little more. Let me.
No, it was just a way to make money. It was the best way to make money while in college. And you know, I think there's a glamour associated at that age with working in a fine restaurant that you can't afford. And so I did that for a few years in Boston, and then I left Boston to go to Los Angeles. I tried to graduate early because I was quite sick of Boston. And I feigned an interest in film in order to be part of the LA program that Emerson had. And then I moved to LA, and then I graduated college and immediately needed a job, obviously, because I had no money whatsoever. And that's when I wound up at Mozza, because I was just literally handing out resumes left and right. I didn't really fit the profile of a good bartender or waiter in Los Angeles, because if you're sort of a skinny, bookish guy, there's like a lot of like handsome, extremely professionally charming men and women ahead of you in line for all of these jobs. Because
hey, don't sell yourself short. You're skinny, you're bookish, but you're handsome.
Thanks very much.
I would tell you otherwise.
They tell me I've got a very good face for podcasts.
You do have a good podcast face, which is why I'm a podcaster. Thank you. Did you know, was Mozza like... Did they hit it hard by that point? Were they famous? Was Nancy sort of a celebrity then, or that was the early stages?
It was an absolute roaring instant success, that restaurant.
Really?
There was a line out the door for 12 hours of the day from noon till midnight. And for me, that was a trial by fire in terms of... Because a month after I began working there as a server, the guy who became my first mentor in wine, David Rosoff, who still is in the LA restaurant scene and wine scene, a wonderful guy, he offered to promote me to manager and to teach me how to be a wine buyer.
Was that done because you really were, you know, involved and interested and I want to know more? He just thought you were a good guy and he needed somebody.
I think he needed somebody. Okay. I think there was a major staffing crisis at that time, and
so was there
the bar
any
was low.
Was there any slant then towards, you know, natural wines, or was just wine generally Italian? I would guess
exactly. It was a small Italian wine list, just 50 selections at that time, and I quickly realized doing the wine list that nobody was there for the wine. They were there for these cult pizzas. That had really become this sort of media phenomenon in Los Angeles at the time. And so I realized that I could just do absolutely whatever I pleased with the wine list and people would just lap it right up. So the first thing I did was banish any grape variety that wasn't native Italian. You know, like, so there was no Cabernet, no Merlot, no Pinot Noir, nothing.
So you made it a pure Italian wine list.
Well, of course, just pure Italian. But then, of course, then I started bringing everything to organics, or as much as possible, as it was possible at the time, because there's
Wait,
still...
Wait, so talk to me about that. You started bringing everything to organics while you were at Mozza, because... What made you realize it made sense then?
Seemed like the hip thing to do. I don't know.
Okay.
I had only a dim awareness of this stuff at that time.
It was sort of...
This is in 2006 at that time.
Enlightenment.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So you do that for what, a few years?
I think I was... At that time, you know, in the wine world, like 2006 to 2008, it was still the... I think an era where biodynamics got a lot of buzz and controversy. As being somehow this sort of witchy version of organics, and it seemed so radical. And I think there's still something I try to address in the early chapters of my book, is that there's still a lot of confusion in the marketplace between biodynamics and natural wine.
All right, so we're going to talk about that, because I think that's...
Not the same story.
It may not be the number one issue, but it's an issue that I think a lot of people... don't understand or grapple with. So let's just stay with the timeline. So you do Mozza, you kind of get to do some fun stuff because nobody's, you know, busting your balls or whatever. But then what happens? After a few years, it sounds like...
I was in line for a big promotion there because I'd moved over to the Osteria Mozza, which we'd opened by then. And then the guy I was working for there, a great sommelier called Jared Heber, he left. And I was kind of like the next in line to be...
Like, you know, the head wine guy?
Yeah, the head wine guy at this much larger, more impressive wine list. And I thought, well, I guess maybe this wine thing could turn into a career for me. It's, you know, if I'm like, I was 25 at the time. I was like, man, maybe I'm going to have like a really cool career in wine. And then some decision was made higher up after David had already offered me the job. He was going to get back to me with a salary offer. And I think at that time, the Batali Bastianic group was, you know, heavily involved in the restaurant. I believe Bastianic still is. Batali not, for obvious reasons.
Right.
And I think someone on their end kind of overruled David, and David ended up having to rescind the job offer. And I was like, buddy, come on, man. You know I can't stay. You can't do that to somebody.
And you know what? In the end, that may have been...
That was the impetus for me to get out of Los Angeles.
So that happens, and I totally get how you feel and screwed. Yep. But how long and why, you know, are you bolting out and going to Paris? I mean, how long does it take to figure out what the next step is?
That was always a... I think
looming.
It was more just because I knew I had, at the time it was pre-Brexit, and I had a British passport through, thanks to my stepfather, who is English. He's from Northern England, and my primary interest in this whole wine thing is actually the writing. I like writing, and wine keeps me writing. And as a writer, I always had a chip on my shoulder about only speaking one language, because all my favorite writers, you know, all of the great, impressive, imposing classics from Beckett to Nabokov and all these things.
Wait,
you
know, so to the
they all spoke many languages.
To the writing point,
yeah.
Obviously, when you started working wine at Pizzeria Mazza, and then you decide to go to Paris, were you writing? Was writing an aspiration? When you got there, that was the time to start it? I mean, is that... Because you corrected me, you started in 2010, not 2015.
Yeah.
This is a little before that, right? Around?
Yeah, basically, as soon as I got to Paris... that was why I wanted to move to Paris, was basically because I figured that would be how I would learn French. And so at least I'd have a second language. And I had met some... fashion designers, some very kind fashion designers and fashion photographers in Los Angeles, who at my going away party from LA, I hadn't quite figured out what the hell I was doing. And they were like, oh, you want to move to Paris? Well, you know, we've got some friends there at this fashion company, and sometimes they hire that way. So maybe we can find you a job.
So the initial hookup was through some contacts and friends.
Yeah, some regulars in my restaurant
who became
friends.
And it pushed you into fashion, yeah. Not wine necessarily.
Exactly, yeah.
So tell me what you were doing and how long.
It turned out to be it was an internship for a Japanese fashion company in Paris, and I ended up working there for 6 years. And it was when I discovered the French 35-hour work week that I realized that I might as well have a second career as a wine writer.
So at the beginning of the fashion thing, you weren't doing much wine.
No, not at all. I moved to Paris really to leave the wine industry.
Did you enjoy that? I mean, did you go to bed happy and wake up anxious to go to work? Did you mind the scene or the vibe in fashion?
It was all quite alien to me.
It was? For like the whole 6 years?
Well, no. I mean, I think I made some wonderful friends through that scene as well, and people that I'm still great friends with. Even, last night at, we did a little book release event at Night Moves, the nightclub next to the Four Horsemen in Brooklyn.
Robert Dentis.
Exactly. And Amanda McMillan, the general manager, she's a friend that I made back in the fashion scene as well, because she was a friend of my colleague Daphne, who was the head of press for New York at the time. And so we met in completely different context.
Very cool.
It was really like a reunion last night. It was really
very
wonderful.
Very cool. So what happens? You approach about 6 years, and towards the end, you're starting to write. You're starting to pursue your passion of wine writing.
No, I mean, I began the blog, the Not Drinking Poison thing, because now I don't even know what to call it, because now it's on Substack. I moved it from Blogger then to WordPress, and now it is on Substack. It's still called Not Drinking Poison. But even like the... You're supposed to call it a newsletter, but I guess it's basically a blog. I don't know.
In all my time spent on it and reading it and seeing an older iteration and the newer one, the Substack, I couldn't figure out exactly what it was. I mean, the content's amazing and I get what you're doing, but I was trying to put the format into, you know, some kind of box, and maybe it didn't matter.
Even one of the main guys at Substack, we were asking him like about the terminology. I was at one point like, do you call this a newsletter? Because when you say newsletter, people think you have to kind of be there signed up to get it. But if it's on Substack, then you can just visit the site and it's all archived there. It's like a blog. And he's like, well, it's true newsletter is kind of a misnomer. You know, I just try to call them Substacks now. So I think he's trying to, you know, become like a Xerox or Kleenex or a, you know.
And that works for you, right? I mean, you don't need any...
I really like Substack. I think it's been a hugely liberating force for me.
I like the format.
Yeah.
All right, so you leave the fashion thing, and I guess it's fair to say that the wine thing, you know, really takes a turn specifically, you know, into wine. So take me in that direction.
Well, I think, one key reason is I was going through a breakup. So, you know, it makes you kind of want to change your life.
Yeah.
But I definitely, you know, there's a, if you like to express things in a very fairly precise way, you're almost a liability when you work in fashion. You know, because...
Why?
When you express things too polite or too precisely, then you've removed any of the mystique that would otherwise allure shoppers or allure consumers.
That's interesting.
So, you know, there's a reason why... You know, there's a reason why, you know, perfume advertisements have no, you know, tasting notes with them. You
right.
know, they're just an image of a beautiful person draped right. in jewels on a beach somewhere.
It's so true.
It's the mystique. So obviously, you know, any descriptive capacity that I have was completely underexploited in the fashion industry. And so I wanted to do something else. I figured it was kind of high time to change my life. And at that time, I'd become fascinated with the kind of the conversation about wine that occurs between vignerons, between winemakers. It's nothing like the kind of the consumer-facing American sommelier kind of discourse, or even American wine writer discourse.
But do you feel that way? Because all those years in Paris, you're now sitting in the wine bars, getting a sense of the scene, and to your point, that's not going on here, or wasn't?
No, it's not that, because, I mean, honestly, even the kind of wine conversation that happens at wine bars in Paris also bores me at this point.
Oh, yeah?
It's quite trite. But I like what happened in Paris is that it's not like in America where you have this three-tier system in a lot of places where, you know, where wine as a subject is mediated by people selling it at all times. You very rarely find yourself sitting and drinking with a winemaker or a vigneron, someone growing grapes, you know, very rarely. Whereas in Paris, you know, because it's such a, you know, it is by and large the cultural capital of, you know, of France, as well as the literal capital of France, you get all the winemakers coming through, the vignerons coming through, and who will be delivering their own wines to the various bistros, you know, parking illegally and, you know, running in with a bunch of cases of wine and then having a splash of wine with the staff and then running off to deliver again.
That's cool.
Or, you, I don't know, you just see, you know, you meet a lot of vignerons living in Paris. And it was at that point that you realized, or that I realized, that the discourse about wine growing, wine making among vignerons was so much more interesting and so much more granular and tactile for me. And so I kind of wanted to be more part of that, more privy to that. And I figured an interesting way to do that would be to move to the Beaujolais. And
why the Beaujolais? That's kind of the birthplace or an important part for the movement, right?
Yes, definitely.
That's why, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like it's the cradle of the natural wine movement, if you want to, you know, call it like
so
that.
So I want a little later into the interview, I want to talk about that, but you go there and you stay there for how long?
About a year and a half full time, and then I was still going back all the time for another 6 months or so. And, you know, kind of 2 years on and off.
And yeah. You're living, writing, embedding yourself in the Beaujolais culture, and don't you help making wine? I mean, you...
Initially, my project, because I quit the fashion industry job because I wanted to, I thought I could write a book about wine. And my big advice for aspiring writers out there would be to never quit your day job until you have the book deal. Because
right.
It definitely took me another 4 years to get
a
book
like
deal.
Sound like a parent now or yeah. something. You know?
It was definitely, you know, 4 years a bit in the wilderness after I quit my comfortable job in an office in Paris. I thought it'd be interesting to write a book about the wines of the Beaujolais. To be honest, I was quite inspired by a British, I believe, wine writer called Wink Lorch.
Yeah, who Wink's wrote, still around, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And she, her book about the Jura region it's very thorough. You know, it doesn't have any specific natural bent, nor does she, but it's very thorough, very educational, and really, you know, goes into a granular study of the terroir, of the local culture, and I really thought that would be interesting to do for the Beaujolais. I thought it would be a nice sort of bite-sized project that would then maybe leave me well-positioned to write a different book about natural wine. And in the end, absolutely zero publishers were interested in that Beaujolais book. it was too narrow focus for a large market like America. And in the end, it was thanks to my fantastic agent, Laura Nolan. She, you know, a couple years down the line, she had learned of someone who was interested in doing a large book about natural wine, and she suggested me for the role.
That's great. So that's how, from Beaujolais to the book.
And of course, the Beaujolais was a very, very key foundation. I think one of the reasons why there aren't more books about natural wine is honestly the Beaujolais genesis of it is a fairly forbidding topic.
But do you have to spend time on that to be honest to cover the topic?
I think
that seems preventative in a way, or hampering.
You know, it depends what kind of approach you take to the topic. I mean, like the first thing that I told the publisher when we were starting this book project was that I don't want this book to be my definition of natural wine. I wanted it to be a really kind of sociological, anthropological approach to natural wine as a cultural movement. It's like if I were writing a book about punk or about hip-hop.
So that's a good segue, because and we and you will take this wherever we want, because, you know, that was a good setup. I mean, I've devoted many episodes, more now than ever, you know, to natural wine, from A to Z, from Alice Firing to Zev Rovine. You know, there's your A to Z, you know, right there. And we've tried, because you have to, on the podcast, define what natural wine is. And I never wanted to put it in that box. You know, here's what natural wine is and all that. But I have you now. Mm-hmm. So however you want to not define it, but... You know,
can I give you a fairly Mandarin and geeky and obscure definition?
Yeah.
I think for me the best definition of natural wine is Thierry Puzelot getting into a fist fight with Alain Castex at the funeral of Marcel Lapierre.
All right, so people, and you know them better than me. So let's just talk about the players, describe them, and who they are. It's sort of like, you know, some fist fight in New York with famous people, but you know why they were Puzelot. Describe who he is.
Well, I think to get into why that's a funny definition of natural wine, you have to talk about Marcel Lapierre first.
Right.
And obviously, I think natural wine has segmented and fragmented in so many ways since his era. He died in 2010, but he began doing his first experiments in sulfite-free vinification in 1978, and he began actually selling a small quantity of wine vinified and bottled without sulfites in around 1984. You hear a lot of different stories about which precise year it was. Despite the fact that the whole natural wine movement has really fragmented and, you know, become very, very global since his era, among French winemakers and even among winemakers abroad, you know, everyone acknowledges his central role in promoting this ideology and promoting an awareness, a consciousness of purity and vinification, and making that a criteria, you know, helping return that to being a criteria, a criterion of good winemaking. It was his funeral. I wasn't there. I have this story secondhand from a number of sources. And that was in 2010. And Thierry Puzelot is an acolyte. He was influenced by Marcel Lapierre as well. He's you could call him probably one of the most influential winemakers of the second generation of natural winemakers. He joined his brother Jean-Marie Puzelot at their estate in the Loire-et-Cher, which is about 2 hours and a bit west of Paris, near the town of Blois. And he joined his brother at his estate there in 1994. But before then, he had worked, worked around in various other estates in Burgundy and in Provence. And I believe, as I understand it, and this could be contested as well by several of the participants, but as I understand it, he became connected with the Marcel Lapierre circle at that time, which was already kind of a thriving little underground, through an enologist called Jan Roel, who he met while he Puzelat was working as vineyard manager of or cellar master of Domaine de la Tour du Bon in Bondol. And anyway, Puzelat got into Lapierre circle, fell in love with this notion of naturalness and vinification, because it still wasn't called natural wine at that point. It was still called vin sans sulfites, which is a bit of a misnomer, but wine without sulfites.
That's how it was referred?
In the early circles in the 1980s and 1990s.
Was that zero sulfur or just very low sulfur?
Often just very low, yeah. But sometimes zero. It really depended on the estate. So that's Thierry Puzelat, who then, of course, he's still a really fantastic, incredible winemaker, has an estate called Clos de Tubeuf.
Right.
They do a lot of beautiful estate wines. They also do a lot of négociant wines, which is where they purchase the grapes. He also works as a wine importer, importing some of the leading lights of Italian and Spanish and Georgian natural wine into France. He's got his fingers in a lot of pies. And then I guess there was a dispute
about
Alain Castex's wine, as I understand. Alain Castex is a figure really more from the... I believe he began making wine in, I want to say, 1985 in Corbière at the time. But then he got into natural winemaking later. He worked with his wife, Guylaine Manier, in Banyuls. And that was from around the mid-90s at some time. I don't have the exact year off the top of my head. And influenced by people like, I believe, Bernard Balassin, who's a Languedoc vigneron, who's still alive as well. He got into natural winemaking as well, and also influenced by people like Lapierre as well. But he represents a different wing of the natural wine movement these days, more radically opposed to sulfite addition than someone like Puzelat, who will use it if he feels he has to.
Wait, so is my take that he's more extreme than Puzelat?
In that regard, yes.
And was that part of the riff?
Apparently, I'm sure they've patched it over at this point, but right. It was someone had heard someone badmouth their wines in Paris and say that there was some volatility or mouse in the wines, and it led to a fist fight at a funeral in the Beaujolais. And this, I think, is a snapshot of kind of where the natural wine scene is today. That's kind of the contemporary discourse within the natural wine scene. It is almost no sulfite addition radical enough.
Really?
Yeah, is where the conversation is, I think.
So that's...
that's one of the key factors in the conversation today.
It's funny, it's not that I'm trying, but... You know, I want to be able to explain or define natural wine, and you come back to me with sort of this,
this
fight,
really
which is great.
Really obtuse.
But, I want to throw back to you that
the
title of your book is The World of Natural Wine. What is it?
Okay.
So that warrants an answer.
Who makes it
and why it matters? But I think based on how you answer the question, and I read the book, is it's not an answer. It's... There are many different things that lead to the answer, and I think that's what's beautiful about the book.
I'm being a little bit coy about that.
No, I know.
On some level, you can simply say that it is, or at least I think a few would disagree with me if I say it's wine made from grapes that were farmed more than organically, which is to say at least organically, but ideally with organics as an entry way, as the beginning of a path towards better farming. So made from grapes... farmed in such a way, vinified without additives, transformative enological procedures, and with almost no or zero added sulfites, and with neither fining nor filtration.
Right. That's really the basic.
Yeah, I mean, for me, those are like... one still finds a lot of filtered natural wine, filtered purportedly natural wine. That's sort of a particular bugaboo of my own.
I was going to say, is filtration... I know that's... Yeah. It's not really natural wine if there's filtration. But there are natural wines that are filtered?
There are many respected natural wine estates who will still filter some of their wines.
Using fining, or are they running it through these...
Filtration, often with the diatomaceous earth filtration.
Okay.
Yeah, or various cartridge filtration or plate filtration. It's a really nebulous subject, filtration.
To me, we talk about defining natural wine, but to me, and I want to talk to you about this before we get into the book, because there's specifics in the book. You said it in the book, it's not just a beverage, but a culture, and there's an ethical imperative. And that's what's important overall about wine, and I want you to, talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned that in the very first, in the little introduction text that I wrote for the book. And that really came from living in a winemaking community in France. You see the ravages, both environmental and in terms of the health of the local populace. The amount, and obviously I won't cite particular cases because it seems a little bit indelicate to use somebody's health condition or some family's tragedy as a way to push natural wine. But the amount of cases of birth disabilities or early onset cancer that you see in winemaking communities in France is astonishing and tragic.
Yeah. Yeah, people have not talked about that.
Yeah. And
these guys are literally living on it.
Yeah, I mean, I had a friend in the Beaujolais lost his mother and his uncle within the span of 2 or 3 years from each other, both in their early 40s, both to cancer, and that's not normal. It's really just not normal. And this is linked to the use of herbicides. It's linked to the use of synthetic pesticides. I mean, the estates that employ these methods of farming always say that they're doing it because it's an economic imperative for them in order to keep wine cheap for consumers abroad on export markets. And conveniently, these consumers abroad on export markets never need to see these environmental ravages and the ravages to the health of the community. It's a horrible thing to try and raise children, not that I've done this, but raise children where they can't walk on the vines because it's poisonous.
Right. I mean, wasn't there a time before the war people were pretty practical about that, and then it became more industrialized where,
herbicides really, they came into the scene in France in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And they maybe a little earlier.
It kind of terrorized everything for the last 40 years or something.
Well, it's the point where when we, as recently, for example, in the news, there was some news about the death of the fellow who created Tubac Chuck.
Oh, Francia.
Yeah. And of course, there's images of this fellow in his obituaries, and his obituaries were all fairly even-handed, discussions of his career. And you see this guy pictured for press images in his vines, and his vines are like an absolute atrocity, like machine-pruned, monoculture to the horizon.
Well, that's the ultimate in that example, right?
Yeah,
that's the industrial formulaic turnout.
And you think how many readers of these major news media publications are looking at that viticulture and realizing what an atrocity it is, like what an economic, an ecological, and human health catastrophe it is. We don't twig it. When we look at images of vineyards, you look at every conventional estate on earth. They're putting beautiful images of their vineyards in their brochures and everything, and nobody
the Napa
twigs.
Napa vineyards are these rolling, trimmed, cover.
But people don't twig the absence of grass cover. That is unnatural.
What's good
that is
the
bizarre.
Opposite of yeah. what's shown. Which
yeah,
is crazy.
Exactly, yeah, I mean, everyone should know that. Like, vines have grass. It's just weird when they don't have grass.
Yeah. All right. We have to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to get into the book. So we're talking to Aaron Ayscough. Aaron just wrote his new book, The World of Natural Wine. When we come back, we're going to get specifically into a lot of stuff in the book, stuff that we broached. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Sprezzatura, an Italian noun that means a studied carelessness. Picture this: woven basket in hand at the farmer's market, shucked oysters, ripe tomatoes, rapini, crusty bread, and a perfectly chilled bottle of Pet Nat. Cunning lilacs to set the tone, red lipsticks, friends arrive, table is set, slow dance under the sun, barefoot on the grass. A cheeky smirk while lighting up a cigarette. Apron comes off, inhibitions do as well. Hello friends at Grape Nation, I am Mariana Velasquez, author of Colombiana the Cookbook, and I created a line of hosting ware, Casa Velasquez, as an extension of my life, inviting you to fully embrace your imperfect unbridled self. Come with me to casavelasquez.co and reimagine your hosting essentials so we can set the tone for your table and home. Casa Velasquez is a mutual supporter of Heritage Radio Network.
Will climate change alter the beer and wine we drink? Come find out at Fern Talks and Eats in Brooklyn the evening of October 24th. The event will include a panel discussion with leading writers and makers, including wine writer Alice Fearing, Garrett Oliver, head brewer at Brooklyn Brewery, and science and nature writer Rowan Jacobson. Come taste the future with a special selection of beers and wines. More information and tickets are available at thefern.org. This episode is supported by HRN Business Member, the Food and Environment Reporting Network.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Aaron Ayscough. Aaron, let's talk about the book, and we can get deeper into some of the things that, you know, we've already talked about. You know, I want to talk a little more about farming and all that. But I just want to say, you know, I read the book. I read it, and then I used it as a reference guide when I put the interview together. And I think it's brilliant.
Thank you.
I think it's rich. I think it's deep.
Thanks.
It's informative. And it's incredibly thorough. You know, when you talk about getting into a topic, it's like, gee, I was left without this or that. You broach other wine regions and you do it well, but we'll talk about why, you know, you approached it the way you did. Just quickly, I always have to get the vitals out of the way. So what prompted you to write the book? I mean, like, you'd been on the ground in Beaujolais, you'd worked in wine.
It was that the publisher wanted a book.
So it was really like, hey, why don't you...
I mean, this wouldn't... I would never
write, and you love to write,
yeah,
so...
Yeah, I mean, but I never would have elected myself to try and to try and tackle the entire subject of natural wine. That's why, like I said, I think I mentioned, I touched on it earlier, but when they asked me to write a book about all natural wine, I was like, well, look, here are the ways that could possibly be achievable. And I said, we have to focus on it as a cultural movement. We have to talk about, really, the 1980s, the 1990s, the 2000s.
When you say a cultural movement, are they like, well, what do you mean? You know, we just want you to write a book about wine.
It was a little bit like that, yes.
There was some of that?
Yeah. I think in America, it's been kind of confused as sort of a simple lifestyle choice, you know, or something. And it is to some extent. There's an ethic and an aesthetic in natural wine. But it's not like a wellness thing. Which is a huge miscommunication about it in America.
When did all that hit? You know, when you spoke to the publisher about, you know, writing a book, was that 3, 4, 5 years ago?
That was in 2019, January 2019, okay. that we signed the book deal.
And you buy in pretty quickly, and you start putting together the idea of the book.
Yeah, well, I'd put together the pitch before then, because signing the actual contract is later on in the process, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to write it?
I mean, really, it's included. There's some of those pictures in there that I took back in 2013. You know,
stuff that's just part of your life's movement.
Yeah, but really, I've been trying to work on a wine book since 2015. A lot of the material that I'd been kind of putting together for what was intended as a Beaujolais book that found its way into this book about natural wine as a whole. But really, in terms of officially working on this exclusively, that's been since 2019.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the book now, not what you did to write it, but is this the type of book that will warrant, in a good way, say 3, 5, 7 years from now, an update?
I certainly hope so.
Because this is an ever-moving...
I mean, there's even errors that we're going to correct in the second printing of this one.
Yeah, but that goes without saying. Yeah. But I mean, the world is so exciting that it's going to require...
Yeah, I mean, if there's a demand for it, I'd be happy to update. I mean, there were already many, many estates that I would have liked to have included in the book that, due to page limits, I wasn't able to.
Right.
Yeah, and so that was a whole politically touchy thing to figure out as well.
There's basically three parts of the book. I mean, you open the book with a section on how to think about wine, how the grapes are grown, and how natural wine is made.
Yes.
I think the bigger picture for natural wine is that it's not just good for our palate, but for the planet. And we broach the farming thing, but I guess, and I want to reemphasize how important farming and farming practices are in natural wine and in the world, and why isn't everybody doing that?
Exactly, yeah. Why wine isn't a great entry point to talking about farming is that it's a subject that often is seen as frivolous. It's not a basic human need. It's not, you know, food, clothing, or shelter. It's wine. We don't actually need it to live as much as many, you know, vignerons might want to convince you otherwise. But and so if we are going to enjoy it, drink it, make it part of our lives, then like the first criteria should be that it doesn't kill the planet.
Is covered well enough in other areas, in food, organic
not
food?
At all. I mean,
no, I mean, I think there's more of a passion here in wine.
It's passion in wine because at least it's you know, grapes and then wine happen to be a product that is intimately reflective of the circumstances of its production. Whereas it's a little harder for us to taste a turnip and know whether it's an organic turnip or a chemically farmed turnip.
Right.
But turnips are just as important on some level.
Well, yeah.
I mean, there's almost like a market and media reality why we're not talking about the necessity of restaurants to work with exclusively organic or more than organic produce, because it's nearly impossible for them to exist, in our current economy, while working with exclusively organic or more than organic produce.
Is that that's an economic thing or availability or?
I mean, probably a little of both, but I mean,
yeah.
I mean, how few restaurants market themselves that way? Almost none.
Well, and many years ago, farm to table, and on the back of the menu, they'd give you their suppliers.
Which is
people
great.
Still
I'm all
do
for that,
that. But it is a very small amount in that sense.
And is it everything, or is it just their proteins that they're giving you their sourcing from? You know, where's the celery coming from? You know.
Yeah. So the book, it certainly helped me, and it very skillfully talks about natural wine and people. Natural wine we talked about is a big box, but you were able to, drill it down a little. There's organic wine, there's biodynamic wine, and then really the third category is natural wine. And just because a wine is organic or necessarily biodynamic doesn't mean it's...
Not at all.
Explain that to me a little. You know, people are like, okay, this is good, it's organic.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely deal with that, at a reasonable length in the beginning of the book, and to kind of summarize it here, it's that... The organics, you have to really look at them as separate cultural movements as well. I'd say the most, I mean, the thing is, I guess to say it in the most simple nutshell kind of way, you can walk to the supermarket at the end of the road or whatever and buy an organic, sometimes even a biodynamic wine, and these still will not be natural wines.
That's my point.
The organics and biodynamics are systems of farming. And neither of them are really rigorous enough within themselves.
When you say to farming, is it exclusive to farming? Organics and
biodynamics? No, biodynamics, both organics and biodynamics, they do also have...
Emphasize cellar practices.
They do put some limitations on cellar practices, but limitations that are nowhere near rigorous enough.
So give me an example, because it's laid out well in the book. How, let's take farming practices organically, biodynamically, and natural... You're not doing certain things naturally that are being done or you shouldn't be.
Well, that's when you talk about just farming. I mean, natural is not a certification. It's important to make that really clear.
No, I know.
Yeah, it's a self-policing subculture within the wine world, and there are many natural estates that decline.
Certification.
Yeah, certification.
But practice, but proper practice.
Exactly. Yeah. And on that level, it does require a certain level of trust in the estate. And I think that the only thing really encouraging that trust is the fact that natural wine is this small self-policing subculture. Vignerons who find themselves abusing that trust with their peers find themselves slowly sidelined within that community.
That's it, though. I mean, the vignerons care and are involved in their self-policing. I mean, that's the difference.
Ideally, yes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Not exclusively, but ideally. I mean, that's an important thing.
I think there's this continual conversation in the wine media about, like, well, saying that consumers on the mass market need to be able to trust natural wine estates, so natural wine must be codified and certified. And I think that's based on a certain misunderstanding of the scalability of natural wine.
How?
In the sense that great natural wine estates, no one is having difficulty selling their wine. It's all already sold.
I know. To the point where you can't get it.
To the point where they don't need to... Prices have gone up. They really don't need to make themselves more available to an ever larger mass market. It mistakes, oftentimes, many of these estates' own personal ambitions with growth. They simply are not interested in that. Not interested in raising their price due to demand. Not interested in any of these things. And yet, we still have a lot of, you know, wizened voices in the conventional wine media saying, well, how does Joe Schmo understand this, and how will he trust you guys, and how will he trust natural wine estates? And the answer is, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all right. That's an interesting point. Let's move along in the book, because I really think I said this to you off air too. I'm intimidated by how much information is in the book. And after doing so many podcasts, it's like, how do you broach all these things? And, you know, my way out is just go out and buy the book. You know, hopefully, you know, this will point you in that direction. But there's a section in the book called The Pantheon of Natural Wine. That's where you discuss the wine regions, you know, Loire, Beaujolais, Champagne, and all that. Explain why the book, and there's a reason, is predominantly focuses, you know, on France.
Yeah.
And there's a singular importance, and we broached it a little, about Beaujolais.
Yeah. It was about taking a really cultural, sociological sort of approach to natural wine and how it came to be, why we began talking about natural wine. If you want to talk about that story, it's a story that begins in the Beaujolais with people like Marcel Lapierre, Jacques Néaport, Jules Chauvet, who are all discussed at length in the book. They found an audience among a group of eccentrics in Paris in the 1980s, notably François Morel, Bernard Pontonnier, and various others.
These were wine bar owners
who then, you know,
they were the conduit.
They were the initial kind of enthusiasts for this idea of winemaking without sulfites, which was very novel at that time, because no one believed it could be done. Basically, it was winemaking had already come to rely to such an extent on sulfite addition that no one ever tried to do it without it, or to try to nearly eliminate it, and so they began really supporting these winemakers. And then Paris, the thing about Paris is that today it is still the world's most visited city. It's a huge window to the world. And so there were three distinct waves of early natural wine establishments in Paris, beginning in the 1980s, going into the, you know, 2000s. Now, obviously, there's still a bazillion today. It's a very, very developed market for natural wine. And it was this visibility in Paris that led to it becoming a big thing in Tokyo, in Copenhagen, in San Francisco, in Oakland, and New York. And, you know.
Yeah, that's exciting. I mean, talk about Tokyo. I mean, Copenhagen with Nome and all that's been going on for a while. But
yeah,
it's nice. They're
very early adopters of the aesthetic. Yeah.
There are, I think there's 13 sections on all the regions, and then the last section, which may be the 14th, you call it Europe and the Caucasus.
It's a bit,
which to me, I'm glad you did that, and when we talk about maybe doing, you know, an updated version, maybe that opens up more, but correct me if I'm wrong, some of the most exciting things happening are in that Europe and Caucasus thing, like Austria and Spain all over. Talk to me outside of France about, you know, some notable things.
Oh, of course. I mean, I'm the first to tell everybody I speak to that I find those sections of the book to be embarrassingly cursory and superficial. They really just give it a very bird's eye, you know, kind of overview of what has happened since the development of this thriving natural wine community in France. I mean, my cutoff for estates, for including them as like kind of full page listings in that kind of pantheon of natural wine, was I was trying to make that around 2007, 2008. I think the youngest estate that I have in the profile there, I think, is like Rupert Loire in Champagne, who began in 2010, around there, where they've got a full page profile. And then if we want to talk about the natural wine cultures that have arisen in Catalonia, in Georgia, in
Styria,
and all these places, they've really coalesced into their present kind of natural wine identified scenes after what happened in France. So really, I was trying to take a fairly dispassionate, cold chronological approach to this, and that's my justification for giving such short shrift to so many scintillatingly nuanced and beautiful wine cultures that exist outside of France.
You know, it's funny you say short shrift, because that's a little hard, but the coverage isn't as extensive as some of the other things.
But some of these areas
and winemakers are as jamming as anyone else.
Absolutely.
Anywhere.
Yeah,
you know,
I would love for someone to pay me to write a similar book on just Italy. That'd be incredible. I would adore
Italy,
that.
Italy, I think, after France, very much embraced, the natural wine movement.
Yeah, and
so let me ask you a sterile question, because I think this is important and it's cool. You basically, when you talk about all the regions, whether it's Jura or the Loire or Beaujolais and all that, you basically adhere to a format. Like, in each section, it's kind of cool that the same information is disseminated. You know, there's dining recommendations, there's history and all that. You know, just talk me through, when you talk about each region, that you make sure, extensive coverage of the winemakers.
Yeah, I think I was really trying to keep the book really about natural wine and not to have to make it like an almanac of all French wine regions. And so that's why in the beginning of each chapter, I try to talk about each region's particular history and relationship with this notion of natural wine. Because it's important, I think, within kind of America, mass media, wine discourse, we tend to just talk, people generalize about French wine or generalize about Italian wine. But really, like, that's an absurd notion. Each of these regions has a vast and long and varied winemaking history that is quite peculiar and unique to itself. You really have to talk about regions as if they're their own nations, and sometimes even sub-regions of regions as if they're their own nations.
Right.
The wine culture of Bordeaux has literally nothing in common with the wine cultures of any other region of France. It's organized completely differently. It's very strange. And it's due to the fact that that was once part of England. So it's important to remember, with these kind of countries, that their unification, as nation states, is relatively late. It definitely postdates their long winemaking history. So that's why I talk about their unique winemaking histories of each, or natural, you know, their unique histories within natural wine. And then I talk about the wines to know, which is kind of just a couple of famous natural wine bottles from those regions.
You lead every section with literally specific bottle pictures and recommendations.
I wanted that list to be like
that. And believe me, people love that.
I mean, I really, I guess the idea is that at the end, if even if you know nothing about natural wine, I was hoping that people would be able to pick this book up and then not sound like idiots when they talk about natural wine afterwards.
I think you've accomplished
that. That's the...
You talk about tasting destinations, like I said, dining, recos. And I think one of the cool things is you do a thing called Legends in the Making. So you have a wine region that's established with great winemakers, but either it's a generational thing or a new guy is coming and making wine and making some noise, and you make note of that.
The Legends in the Making section at the end of each chapter, that was kind of a way for me to talk about younger estates that some of them are already legends, you know, like Julie.
Give me an example.
Julie Balagny in the Beaujolais. She should have gotten her own page, because her winemaking, you know, history goes back much further than the creation of her estate in the Beaujolais. She used to be the winemaker at Terre des Chardons, near Nîmes, I believe, but she only created her estate in the Beaujolais in like 2009, so that seemed to be sort of after the cutoff. So then I didn't include a full page, and I kind of regretted that in the end. Julie was a huge help to me as well. She helped me find a place to stay when I moved to the Beaujolais in 2015.
Oh, nice.
So she's a friend and an inspiration.
Bit of an emotional attachment.
So those legends in the making sections, I really use those to really shine a light on younger estates that were my friends, a lot of them.
Very cool. We talked about this a little earlier, but I want to, you know, kind of tighten up the question. The role that importers, wine bar owners, retailers, sommeliers, I think they've been the movers and the cheerleaders for natural wine, and without... you know, that sort of cadre of people. I mean, you agree?
Absolutely.
You talked about early Paris, you know, bringing in the...
Initially, those were intended to be much larger sections in the book. So the third portion of this book it discusses how to find natural wine, how to taste natural wine, how to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so initially, I was planning to really devote long areas to profiles of prominent sommeliers and prominent importers and I soon realized that was going to be impossible, because it would end up taking up like as much space as the entire section devoted to
I'm okay with that. Yeah. And I realized that there's
also,
that many
it would have
people.
Gotten super political as well. It was going
but
to be
categorically they're very influential.
Absolutely. People like Eric Nariot of Cave de Pirene in London, who also with his wife Anna Martens does Vino di Anna in Sicily. His career really, really traces the formation of the natural wine scene and movement. He was one of the first importers of Pierre Auvernois, and who's a famous Jura winemaker. And he's an incredibly inspiring and intelligent
What's
wine
ironic
genius
is
for me.
We're at Franchet and we're with our friend Jorge. And when you talk about the New York natural wine scene, it's not that old. It's not a... And Jorge dates back to the beginning with 360 and Balthazar when, I forgot his name, was it Nocitor, you know, who went on to make Mondavino and all that. I mean, it all progressed, and, you know, here's a guy. And we're at Franchet 5 years ago. This was the first all-natural wine list, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but...
Yeah, no. It takes a lot of will and force and charm, I think, to be able to surmount people's
champagne,
people's prejudices and about natural wine. And honestly, it's all a question. There's a beautiful word that Dominique Derain used to me once in French, and like about talking about people's experience with wine and their openness towards natural wine. And he was saying it's always a question of paramétrage, so your parameters basically, and how you adjust them, and how they happen to be set. It really is it's your paramétrage when you're tasting wine is your previous wine experience. And I think we're at a time in mass culture where several generations have gone by without people tasting even an unfiltered wine.
So that leads into my next question. I think wine drinkers, mainstream wine drinkers, are accustomed to drinking traditional wines.
Well, that's traditional what they know. Is a word I don't like to use to regard to, with regard
well,
to conventional
whatever
wines.
The other stuff is, I mean, there's incredibly discernible differences.
Absolutely. Well,
you know,
I mean, you look at what
you
what
talk about that
what is
in
the
book.
What is the goal of a conventional enologist? and that is to make a wine estate profitable and economically sustainable.
But he does that by making the wine the same
thing. By commodifying
thing.
The heck out of
right.
the wine.
Right, so yeah. that the beauty of wine is the difference in the vintage, the,
is
how
that
the
it's
climate
not Coca-Cola.
Affects. Yeah, I mean, the other way is, we're not going to name specific wines, but they just taste the same. They're always deep, dark purple.
And everyone always says, oh, well, you know, you're spending so much money on a bottle of wine, you want it to be a consistent experience. But that's just not what agricultural products are. And wine is, first and foremost, you know, it's not a futures commodity, it's an agricultural product.
I always worry, and I think as time has passed by, it's not as bad, but I worry that people who stray into natural wines for the right reason, there's an inconsistency, there's a funkiness, there's a mousiness, there's a cloudiness, you know, which could be off-putting, and those are the trademarks, you know, of natural wine.
But that's
you know, so how do you taste natural wine? I mean...
And well, it's about adjusting one's parametrage. I think so much of the way we taste wine posits this moment of tasting between the consumer and the wine glass as being like the be all and the end all. This point of judgment where the work of the farmer, the winemaker, everything is being judged by the consumer and leads to that moment. And I think that's a terribly outdated and sad way of tasting and assessing wine. Really, it's like we should consider ourselves, from my perspective, I think we should consider ourselves students of the winemakers and of the vignerons,
right,
and of these pre-existing wine cultures that predate
the story part
that predate
that.
Our own preferences.
Yeah.
So, in my own kind of journey learning about wine, I've always tried to learn from vignerons and really get as close to the source as possible. That's what I do on the Substack that I write, the Not Drinking Poison thing. That's where all the where I end up putting a lot of the kind of primary source documents.
So let's talk about Not Drinking Poison.
Yeah.
It's an active writing opportunity for you. I mean, are you writing on a regular basis? Do you disappear and then come back?
I try every 2 weeks to three weeks. I try to
so
put something on there.
Yeah. A couple times a month type thing.
Yeah, once or twice a month. Mostly because I'm basically breaking all of the rules of this platform, because this platform is always encouraging us to...
Substack, which is very liberal, you're breaking even those rules?
You know, they're always saying, like, you know, you should check in with your readers like twice a week. And I think that's horrible. I would hate to receive emails from somebody I don't personally know more than even more than once a week is irritating. Even once a week is a little much. You know, as important as wine is, it's not that important that you need to hear about it from the same person twice a week, I feel. So basically, I try not to flood people's inboxes with my newsletter.
Are you lying in bed saying, I got to write about this? Or, I mean, do you have like a list of things that you're trying to get to?
Definitely. I don't have enough time to deal with it all. There's so much beautiful subjects out there, and there's.
Okay.
I mean,
why wouldn't you write three, four times a month? Why wouldn't you write more?
Because I'm here with you, Sam.
Okay. Well, you. Let's disclaim that you just wrote a book, which took a lot of your time.
It's 440 pages, Sam.
You're in the States promoting it, and I must admit, kudos to you. You're on an extensive promotional tour. So just tell me, Not Drinking Poison, what's the best way to jump onto that?
Just do a Google search for me or for Not Drinking Poison, and it should be one of the first two results, and it's on the Substack platform. I made it as cheap as possible. The Substack platform makes you ask for if you do paid subscriptions.
Oh, really?
Which I do.
So to you, it's more about hitting the minimum low and getting people in.
Well, I wanted to. I don't think this should be completely Mandarin knowledge. What a real wine is, what I try to express on this with this newsletter. And as I was saying, the newsletter is where I put a lot of interviews with winemakers. I realize it's my favorite format these days, because I go there and I do an interview like we're doing now, only I don't put it on a podcast. I transcribe it,
right?
And I translate it to English.
What's the current story? Can you remember?
Oh gosh,
I looked. I forgot.
Yeah, me too. I forget.
Well, even
I've been writing a lot about Burgundy recently, because there's a lot of really there's a beautiful and very dynamic and welcoming scene of young natural winemakers in Burgundy these days.
Yeah,
and
when people think of Burgundy, they think of it a certain way.
Don't think
way,
of welcoming.
But when you think of it, you know, from the natural wine perspective, there's a lot of exciting things going on. All right, Aaron, we've been at this almost an hour. I told you it'd go quickly. I want you to do a thing that we call the wine list, where we ask our guests preferences. It's very spontaneous. Don't dwell on it. five questions. We ask everyone the same five questions. Here's the first question. Okay. What are you drinking now? Not like the second, but like what, like as the seasons change or when you travel, you drink differently than at home. What's in your fridge? You know, what are you doing for research?
I really love this. It's Czech birch sap.
Czech from Czechoslovakia.
It's not wine.
Spell it.
It's a birch sap. So the birch tree.
Is it like
February
like
or March?
Birch beer soda.
You can pierce them, and you get the sap. And there's a friend and called Jan Klimeš, and he's based in the Czech countryside near a lot of birch forests, and he hit upon this recipe of lacto-fermenting birch sap. So it's a way to preserve it without filtration or using additives.
Do you add anything to it, or do you just drink
He does various infusions with it. He also makes some that are just the birch sap lacto-fermented. And because you wait, after 4 months, it lacto-ferments, and it's a beautiful non-alcoholic drink with a light sparkle and no sugar.
Nobody has ever given me that answer, and you had to figure
out. I love it. I've been making some myself these days as well. It's delicious.
You're a birch sapper. So give me something a little more traditional.
Okay. If it has to be alcoholic.
I'm twisting your arm. You can't see it.
Let's see. What do I mean, gosh. In terms of wines that I've kind of come back to often.
Is there a region or a producer? I mean, are you focusing on anything?
I love my friends at Clofontaine in the Languedoc.
Right. You work with them.
Yeah. For the second year in a row, I've done harvest and a little bit of vinification work with them. And they also encouraged me to make some wine last year, which I'm doing on a very non-professional kind of hobbyist basis. But I absolutely adore their wines.
Okay, so Clofontaine.
Yeah.
So the birch sap and Clofontaine. I'll take those.
Yeah.
All right, second question. Fun question, goofy question. Favorite wine and food pairing? Not something you eat every night or every month, but is there something that when it's there, it's like, ooh, ah?
I don't know. I usually...
The way you're reacting, it's not something... It doesn't seem like something...
I usually find myself getting into rants against food pairing whenever anyone mentions food pairing, just because I find it's a very... It's sort of this discourse that comes from our overabundance of choices in cuisine, which is just a feature of, of this late capitalist stage of mass transport everywhere, eating guavas in midwinter and... God knows where, in Alaska,
right.
Watermelon's
a summer fruit, exactly. But we'll grow it in like Patagonia.
And we're wondering what will go with it in the, if we're having like a sushi burrito or something, what goes with that? I don't know. Nothing goes with that.
So the answer is no answer.
No. I mean, okay, in terms of like,
I'm okay with that. No, you just, you.
No, for example, like if I ever eat a roast chicken, I love like some good Beaujolais with that. Some good Cru Beaujolais, some Fleury,
like
some Morvan,
almost anything.
With some roast. Actually, funnily enough, in the region itself, it's always pork this, pork that, constant pork. And I love pork as well, as much as the next guy.
Wait, so Beaujolais is a lot of pairing
within the region. Right. It's just like they say, lard is the favorite vegetable, really, and pork is it's just constant pork in the Beaujolais. But really, I find that those wines, for me, they taste better with a roast chicken. But it is what it is.
All right, third question. These are tough questions for you. I mean, it's different for you. I ask everyone favorite wine restaurant and or bar, and I ask that not like to pick your favorite or leave stuff out, but I ask you just to throw out a few places where the list is great, the vibe is great, the people are great, their knowledge is great, and I think the book kind of answers that question 2-3 times over.
Oh, no, I mean,
but when I ask you personally, is there a place you find yourself at?
These days, the restaurant Le Soleil in Savigny-les-Bonnes, so near Beaune in Burgundy.
Wait, what's the name of it?
It's called Le Soleil, which means the sun.
A couple other people sunshine, on the show have mentioned that.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful restaurant. And my friends Leila Auba and Svante Forstorp are in the kitchen there these days. And they do a very radical thing in the kitchen where they try to eliminate the use of plastic in the kitchen, which is an extremely radical thing, and it changes all of their gestures. They also, as a political thing, they don't work with a dishwasher. They wash all their own dishes during and throughout service, and that also changes their gestures and how they create their dishes.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very revolutionary, I think, what they're doing.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Somebody had mentioned that in the past.
And Lola, the owner, is such a wonderful, wonderful personality.
That's a good one. All right, we'll leave it at that. All right, so here's the fourth question. The fourth question is Aaron Iskoff's favorite all-time wine.
all-time wine?
Now, when I initially structured the question, when I started doing the show, I wanted to find out guys like you, like, what's the rarest, coolest, most expensive wine you ever drank? I've morphed away from the question. I'm more interested in what's the wine that was important to you, either a gateway, changed the way you thought about it, open your eyes, just a significant wine in your journeys to this day. It can be more than one, but...
Yeah, definitely. Yvon Metras is a winemaker in Fleury in the Beaujolais, and his Fleury Vieille Vigne from the year 2000, I tasted it in 2013 over dinner at a restaurant called Le Pot d'Etain near Chablis.
What was the name of the restaurant?
Le Pot d'Etain. That was just absolutely singing. It was a moving, beautiful, extremely like rose-scented, gorgeous Fleury. I mean, everyone always lumps the wines of the Beaujolais in with Burgundy on wine lists just habitually, but I really feel that the region has so much more kinship with the Northern Rhone, and I think Yvon Metras's Fleury in a beautiful vintages, you really see that. It's like there's some kind of like underground, you know, like link with Saint-Joseph, with like the Saint-Épine from Hervé Suo has like a, you know, can have a similar profile.
Because those are two of my favorite regions, you know, the Northern Rhone and
particularly Grille Midi, where
am I wrong in saying this? And I shouldn't even bring it up, but it's hard to get Metras and it's expensive.
Yes, yeah.
And
even in France, it's become hard to get his stuff. But what can you do? I mean,
but we talked about it earlier. Yeah. How, you know, it's things. Yeah.
Really, if I were being very conscientious, I should have referred to a wine that is not famous yet.
So, can you think of one?
Oh, ones that have moved me hugely. Absolutely.
Give
me.
Let's balance it with one of those.
I mean, another one from. Let's see. I mean, I've already mentioned Clofontaine. I probably shouldn't mention them again.
Well, we may mention them in the next sentence, but I'm not sure. But go ahead.
The Cuvée Plan B from Liliane Bauchet. That's also not a very large production wine, but it's also from the Beaujolais, coincidentally. But it's made from Muscaris and Souvenir Gris. It's made from hybrid white wines that are planted in kind of this sort of low-lying, sandy bit of Lancier, which is a Beaujolais village adjacent to Fleury, but it's not considered to be particularly noble or interesting terroir.
Wow.
This wine, I think, is extremely important because it should change the region. The Beaujolais, it's very, very... It's nearly impossible to make excellent white wines with nice acidity in that region. It just doesn't happen. The Chardonnay is what they say in French, mou. You know, it's just... It's like it's flabby and it's... It's kind of candied and lame.
That's a good wine.
And you taste this... You know, France has very much yet to embrace hybrid grape varieties, which are... You know, Vitis vinifera crossed with American grapevine material to produce vines that require less or zero treatments against mildew and oidium. To give you the long explanation, but that is for our listeners. But this one from Liliane Bauchet is absolutely beautiful. There's a really well judged inclusion of lees in the winemaking process. It's textural. It's beautiful. It has a nice acidity. It's agile. That's a white wine that should change the region. Everyone should rip up the Chardonnay.
Yeah, I hope to see that. And, I mean, I'm glad you brought it up and pointed out and talked
plant,
to us a little about
plant
it.
Plant some hybrids there.
All right, here's the last question, and I think you should be able to help me with this. You know, I'm sitting down with everybody in wine from every walk of life, and I'm always kind of looking for, recommend to me the best wine, $15, $20, $22, a red and a white. And here's the setup. You know, my kids are in their 20s. They can't bring to a party or give a gift of crappy $11 industrial supermarket wine, but they don't have $40, $50.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything you could think of about that? Like, I always thought Muscadet is a pretty good value for that. What do you think?
I like Marc Penot's Muscadet. But he's no longer within the Muscadet appellation. He was kicked out.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
Can you think of anything around in
the wine? The Muscadet appellation, I mean, just to kick it in the pants a little bit. The Muscadet appellation is a disaster. It has like a minimum yield requirement, which is completely demented. Like, you know, they will come down on a winemaker for doing too low yields. Which
really?
Is generally that's, you know, how you get a qualitative winemaking is you do a little lower yields. So you don't try and you know, make everything. And
that's crazy.
It's all. I mean, it's also. It's just.
So can you think of anything?
Nearly unanimously filtered and Malo blocked Muscadet. It's like
Jesus, I opened up a can of worms.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like quite high sulfite levels
there. We could do a show on that.
Major high sulfite levels as
what
well.
What about like Vino Verde or something? I mean, give me...
It's probably also pretty filtered Malo blocked as well. Much of that stuff.
But, so Aaron, you have to tell me some good value.
Well, but the thing is, I always try to say like, you know, one of the big messages, you know, that the natural wine movement pushes, you know, throughout is that appellations, unfortunately, are not a very good guarantee of value or of quality or even
so
of style.
So forget appellation. Then.
So forget appellations. Forget entire regions. It's really about the name of the winemaker. And I figure, you know, I often fall back on the metaphor like, you know, even if you're not a major film buff, you can probably remember the name of a director who makes some films you like.
Right.
You know, like whether it's Almodovar or whatever, Fellini or, you know, could be anybody. So, and I don't think that's too Mandarin to ask people to, like, just imagine the winemaker as if he's a director, or he or she, you know, and try and remember their name. And there are some winemakers that consistently produce absolutely beautiful value, you know, well-valued wines.
Give me a couple of names.
Jeff Couteloup, for example. Jean-François Couteloup. He's based north of the town of Béziers in the Languedoc, and his wines are criminally underpriced, if you ask me.
All right, that's why I ask these questions.
And he's a lovely man, an incredible guy.
Give me one other.
Marc Penot, the guy we were just talking about who's in the Muscadet appellation, but he's not Muscadet. His wines are an extraordinary value, and they age forever.
Really?
Yeah, I've had a lot of old wines from him, and these are wines that like you can buy at a wine shop in Paris at least for like $14 or €14, you know.
Wow.
And I've had some dating back, you know, 10 years, 10, 12 years, and they're beautiful. They're ageless. They're pretty amazing.
So I didn't mention this, but you know, we promote the show on social media, mm-hmm. and I do, you know, Aaron's wine list, because people listen every week. And they want to get some, you know, intel or suggestions, you know, from you. So we post the wine list. All right. We have to wrap up the show.
Okay.
But before we do that, we do a segment called the Weekly Wine Tasting. And we're not going to get into it. But I think in front of us, Jorge poured us a Laurent Saillard. Is it S-A-I-L-L-A-R-D? Does that sound right?
You think this is Saillard?
I think it's a Saillard. Jorge.
I don't know if it's Saillard.
Is this the Saillard?
I don't know if it is. I don't think it is.
Tell me what we're drinking.
To me, it tastes a little more like. I would hazard a guess. Maybe.
So this is our weekly wine sip. So Jorge, what are we drinking? Wait, should we have Aaron try to guess what it is?
I'm perfectly happy getting it wrong live.
I suck at this. Go ahead.
My first guess. Like my first instinct was kind of tending towards like a Jurassic Pinot of some kind, but then the length wasn't quite that. I ended up kind of gravitating. It tastes a little bit like the work of Pierre André in Lorraine, but he of course sources grapes elsewhere. But those would be my first kind of instincts. Yeah.
I have no idea. I pick up a nice saline quality, and I pick up a. Yeah. All right. All right, so while he's doing that, we'll tell everyone what we're drinking. Where can people buy the book? I always say, go to Amazon. You know, where?
Of course, yeah. I only found out recently that someone told me that Amazon owns Book Depository. Because I've been telling people to go to Amazon or Book Depository, and now I realize I was giving, like, a false choice. Anyway, but In the USA, I believe it's pretty much wherever books are sold. You can get
it. So go to support your small bookseller, your local bookseller.
Everyone's got it or has access to it.
When people come out, they can go to Not Drinking Poison and see your appearances, right? You'll be selling books?
Yes, at all the appearances. We'll be going to a lot of different cities.
So there's that. So we have a reveal. You have it covered up here. Go ahead.
Oh, no shit. Wow.
Wait.
21. Nice. Wow.
Who is it? Jorge?
It is a 50 Max. Yeah. I can't believe I didn't get that. I can't believe it. This is the caviar of Primeros. It's the caviar of Beaujolais Nouveau. Oh, but no, this is not the Milo. This is his Beaujolais Village. Yeah, exactly.
When you say caviar of Beaujolais Nouveau, why do you say that?
Well, he makes the best one every year. His Cuvée Fanchon. But this is Mary Lou. Both of these cuvées are named after his daughters. Mary Lou is his Eldest daughter.
All right, so I'm going to post a picture of the wine so that people know And I'm guessing because it's Kermit Lynch, you know, you can get it. It's distributed, right?
Yeah.
It's sold out.
Of course.
We were talking about that. We're talking about the whole natural wine movement. You can't get shit.
But hey, the 2022 Primera is about to come out, at least in France.
All right. So everyone's on their own on that. All right, Aaron, we have to wrap up. Let me just do a quick show wrap up. And I want to get some other information. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. If you like the podcast, leave a good review. Follow us on Instagram at sbenruby, on Twitter at benruby. I know that's confusing, but you can always reach us through the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Facebook, we're at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we will post Aaron's wine list answers. There's some interesting stuff there. I may have to email him to get me some spelling or some clarifications on names. I will also post the wine we had for the weekly wine sip on our media sites. So, Aaron, support your local bookseller to buy the book. Come out and see you and you can buy a book. You'll sign it for people. If you're in the middle of nowhere, you're lazy, you can go on Amazon. If we want to, we talked about your Substack newsletter. If we want to follow you on social media, where
do
we go?
Yeah, I'm on all of them. I'm on, you know.
Under what?
My Instagram handle is my name, Aaron Ayskov.
Okay, so it's...
Or there's a Not Drinking Poison Instagram.
Is it... At AaronAyskouh?
C-O-U-G-H.
C-O-U-G-H. Meant that. I just didn't say it. So that's where you can find Aaron. You can follow him. And it's a very exciting time for Aaron. The book is terrific. I mean that sincerely. It's definitely a reference for me, and it's very enjoyable. And I think it's a book a lot of us have been waiting for. So thank you for doing the podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for writing the book. And here's a little secret. And Aaron, correct me if I'm wrong. It's the first podcast you ever did?
This is my first podcast.
You
just popped my podcast,
Jerry. You did good. Yeah. Okay, you did good. Yeah. All right, thank you to our guest, Aaron. Thanks to our engineers at the Heritage Radio. Thank you to everyone at Heritage Radio. I'm Sam Benruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.